Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and thy name we start today's episode. So, dear listeners, welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. I am Asma, at your service as the host. I have the pleasure to be here with two very dear guests, and welcome to the studio, brothers. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for having us.
Wa alaikum assalam. Yep, happy to be here.
Thank you very much. So, it's the ritual, and we're not going to break the ritual, so please introduce yourself very much briefly.
I'm Ali, and I'm a student in the Holy City of Qom.
And I'm Sayyid Mustafa. I'm also a student here. I'm also studying psychology along with Islamic studies.
I wish you both luck and thank you for being here. Well, nowadays, everywhere, we are seeing too much of war, too much of brutality, and too much of excruciating photos, pictures, and emotions all around the world. So people, when they see such brutal images, they cannot stay silent. All of them would react to it in different ways. Though there is propaganda and there's this deception that does not let you see the truth as it is. So I'm just saying that there are millions hand in there, but then there is a truth. So in today's episode, we are coming back to reality and see the truth as it is. And let's say throughout the history, there's always been people who thought themselves to be the best nation, the best group of people. God has just picked them out of the crowd and stickered them like this, the best nation from all around the world. So we want to say, is there any such concept as the better nation?
Well, of course, in reality, there isn't such a thing. I would say that we're all human beings, right? Mm-hmm. And we all are born with different qualities. But unfortunately, you're right. Throughout history, it doesn't even have to be. It could be even on a political basis, for example. Yeah. Atheists, for example, today think they're the best people in the world,
exactly.
For example, right? It could be anything. Some people attach themselves to certain sports and start thinking they're the best in that, mm-hmm. for example, field.
Yeah.
It's a natural tendency for a human being to become arrogant or feel better about themselves over others, I think. And that plays out to a very, very extreme level, unfortunately, which we're going to be discussing today, I believe.
Exactly. So are you, Brother Adi?
Yeah, I guess being better people is, we can actually coin it as, the better the person is in his deeds and all, the better the person is.
Yeah, that's in the eyes of God.
Yeah, in the eyes of God.
Yeah.
Not just, you be good in a particular field and you just put yourself over others.
Or based on your color or race or anything, whatever. It's not based on that, but unfortunately the reality tells us something else.
It's your deeds and it's your qualities that decide if you're a good person or not.
Exactly. Right. So what we see right now is totally different. If you have money, if you have too much of power over other people, you can call yourself the best people around the world. And then you can take people for yourself as your servants, as the lower people, as the people who are there for you to be taken. And if they die, nobody cares. Nobody even would blink an eye for them. And nobody will feel sorry for them because they are called the lower people. Mm-hmm. Let's get to the very core of today's discussion, which is Zionism. And let's talk about that. And if you share a bit of history, I would be too grateful.
Sure. So we're talking about Zionism, and Zionism is, why are we bringing it up, by the way, in the middle of the discussion about people feeling better? Is because Zionism, I think, sort of defines the idea of a nation thinking that they're better than others.
Exactly.
Right?
There's a common term that they use, like, we are the chosen people of God.
Chosen ones.
The chosen people of God. Unfortunately, the chosenness plays out in extreme brutality and suffering for the rest of humanity, right? But the core idea behind Zionism, by the way, is the idea that the Jewish people should have a homeland, right? The history behind it is that they were being kicked out of countries in Europe back in the, you know, early 1900s and, during World War II. And the idea was formed way back then that the Jewish people need a homeland.
Well,
so obviously when people started seeing, hey, these people are, I'm giving you like a 1 minute summary, you know, you'd have to go into history and really look at all the issues and problems that they caused for a lot of these European countries.
As you just said, they were starting to look like a threat for the Europeans. So they decided...
They were extremists, kind of extremists in their beliefs.
Yeah. So they decided to just kick them out and take them and let them be in one specific land. And since the Muslim people are, according to those extremist Europeans, again, a sort of enemy, so they said they would live there together. And if even if they kill each other, it's not a problem. It's not our problem, at least.
Right. I mean, I think it's just crazy, right? I think these people could have gone anywhere in the world. Like, honestly, in the middle of America, they could have created, you know, Israel, right? But it's they're so extreme in their beliefs, right, is what's creating this whole problem. That they're so hardcore in their beliefs, it's hard for us to even imagine, I would say.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, they're moving out there and they're migrating to Israel or Jerusalem. I guess they have their own explanations. Like, they have got this religious importance behind that. There's a whole theory behind it.
Yeah, they say is our land.
That land is, yeah, exactly. But
as a heritage.
Yeah, as a heritage. But it's actually wrong, right?
Yeah, that's
wrong. You just cannot claim as any land, any piece of land to be yours and just evacuate innocent people out of there.
Exactly, yeah. So
let's say even if we say that, yes, that God gave them that land way back, you know, thousands of years ago after Prophet Moses. But does that justify that you need to kill children and women? That you need to, you know, just go crazy in brutality? You know, is that what God wants?
Then let's go for the answer after the break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back. We are talking about an important issue which has been so viral right now. At this moment that we're talking, many people are getting killed, and that's the topic of today's discussion. This is Back to Reality. I'm Asma. Brother Ali and Brother Mustafa are helping me with today's topic. So we came to this point that it's crazy to kill people just because suddenly you get awake and you feel like there is a land in a corner of this world and you have to get there and seize it. And since there are other people in there, and since you call those other people as the not chosen people, then you have to kill them all.
Unfortunately, they don't even call, like, they call us goyims. That's one of the words that they use. Or I think in English, they'll translate it sometimes as Gentiles. And in other places, we're considered as animals, right?
Oh my God.
I mean, at this point, if we've all been watching the news, I think, and we've seen that even their leaders have come out and said this openly, that these people are animals, right? That's unfortunately part of their extreme beliefs. That's unfortunately part of their misinterpretation of I would say, Judaism and God's, you know, what God actually gave them. So that's one of the problems that we're dealing with, is that not only do they believe it's their promised land, they believe that once the greater Israel is formed, you know, that's when, like, God will give them the entire kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. So they're going towards that at 1,000%.
That's what happens, you know, the extreme beliefs that you are better than the rest of the humanity. This often leads you to hatred towards others who do not come under your category or your criteria. Like the rest of the people, be it Christians or Muslims or any other religion, who are not Jews. So this leads to hatred when you have so much of self-love, when you guys admire yourself so much, so you deem the others to be worthless. And that leads you to doing any sort of
You actually
atrocities.
Get away from your humanity and you start to be yourself an animal. The other fellow who's living there in the same sky, breathing the same air, is not as important as me because I'm different from those people and because I'm chosen one.
Right, exactly.
There exists such extremist point of view in other religions as well. Like we could compare the Zionists, these extremist people, we could compare them with the ISIS. Like the Muslim people are not like that.
Definitely. Extremism, we're not saying it's only limited to, for example, Zionism. You know, we find similar extremism, for example, unfortunately, within Islam when we saw that in the form of Daesh and ISIS, right? Although I would say in brackets that ISIS was formed by Zionists, but that's a separate story. But
that's an offspring of Zionism, of course.
Right. But they used, how did they do that? You know, they use Islamic knowledge or Islamic sources.
As and their slogans.
They took the most extreme interpretation they could and they ignored a lot of it, right?
What I would prefer over here is, you know, instead of using the term religion, we can use like different groups. You know, as it is believed to be that, you know, Zionism is separate from Judaism. Like Judaism is a religion, and Zionism is a political ideology or something. Like it's a movement. Yeah. And for example, like Islam is a religion, and it has no similarities or no connections with Daesh or ISIS. It's a group. It's a terrorist group. It has nothing in relation with Islam.
Exactly.
So, like, these are two, like, extremist groups.
Yeah, so we should notice the very fact that religions, like, as if we consider ourselves as Muslims, we do respect Prophet Moses, and we do respect his book. We have been told to do so according to our own prophet. So there is a difference between these extremist sort of, let's say, school of thought, and then the religion itself. But then what happens to them to feel like they could get their land by killing other people and it's okay?
Well, unfortunately, their religion, well, not their religion, I would say their interpretation of their religion or Zionism, that's sanctioned it. It's allowed it, right? They're allowed to kill children and women. Of course, you'll find many Jews who are against Zionism and against these rabbis as well, the ones that are normal human beings, I would say, and they care about others, right? We're not saying that every single Jew is bad or anything like that. Of course, we're talking about the ones that are Zionists, that are extremists. Yeah. Right. So yeah, it's allowed. In a recent statement made by Netanyahu, he invoked the word, I believe it was Amalekites. It's a word that appears in their books. And it talks about being able to kill children and women. And not only that, they say burn everything, like their cattle, their trees. Whereas in the religion of Islam,
like destroy them completely.
Yeah, destroy them completely. Yeah, completely. That's
it's more of a political movement.
It is.
To brainwash those people who believe in religion.
In this situation, the things are like what we are watching every day, you know, the news updates, the videos coming from Palestine. Everything is, you know, as clear as day. You can decide like who are being oppressed and who are the oppressors.
But many people still on the other sides of the world would believe that the Zionists are the ones who are being oppressed.
Well,
it all depends on upon the news that, or the media or the false
the
media.
The propaganda.
Yeah, the propagandist, the propaganda media. These are the various factors, right? Like if you get the right news, any human being, when he watches these videos, it's, you know, it's as clear as day to decide like who are the oppressors and who are being oppressed.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you know this. Do you know the slogan of Mossad? Do you know the slogan that they use?
What is
in
it?
In Hebrew, if you translate it, it's by way of deception, make war. Okay, so they're openly saying they were going to deceive you and make war.
Yeah.
I mean, they're literally telling you we're going to be lying to you, okay, in their slogan. How it's kind of ironic, but a lot of us don't know this, right? And unfortunately, that's another extreme Zionist ideology is that you can deceive people.
Yeah.
You can deceive them and destroy them.
So how bad it is, like, these are the roots of their beliefs.
We could still go, like, for hours because there's too much of brutality, there's too much of oppression for the people who are living in peace in their own land, and then suddenly someone comes as a Caesar and then kills all of them and shed too much of blood in there under the slogan that, okay, this is our promised land. Where is humanity then? So I guess there's a lot of things to think about. This episode is just going to work as a trigger for you guys to go and search and find out the truth by yourself, I suppose. It's just a moment of thinking. I guess that could work like a trigger, and then you would go for it and search more and more. So thank you for staying with us until another episode. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Welcome to the Israeli Watch program, which took a tour to evaluate the scenes across Gaza, as well as the losses inflicted on the occupation forces by the Palestinian resistance forces there. Not to mention the fiery circumstances at the borders with South Lebanon in the face of Hezbollah and the dilemmas that Netanyahu faces on the internal arena. I welcome Mr. Hadi Kobesi, head of Al Etihad Center for Studies. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let the beginning of our show today be with the strong combat of the Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza and the accomplishments they have been accomplishing in the face of the occupation forces. These topics were the center of attention for the Israeli media, as well as these media outlets that paid attention to the videos circulated by the Qassam brigades. So there are no signs that the Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza have been defeated. This is actually a fact to which a retired major general of the Israel Defense Forces, Giora Eilon, has admitted, and he acknowledged that the Palestinian resistance fighters are well trained. So, Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, let us stop at the impact of the military videos at zero distance and destroying Israeli vehicles and tanks disseminated by the Qassam brigades on the Israeli media. What is the impact of such videos on the Zionist arena?
First of all, let us talk about numbers. The Israelis brought 900 tanks into the strip. So far, they have lost some 120 tanks during almost 6 days of ground confrontations. These tanks took only 120 missiles to be destroyed, which is a small amount of missiles of what Hamas owns. Only two fighters participated in targeting each tank, if not the same fighter actually hit several tanks. Then we can say that some 200 to 250 fighters participated in targeting the Israeli tanks. If they keep this pace until the end of the month, I think Israel will have some 500 destroyed tanks and a few thousand soldiers killed. Now we're talking about some 500 killed soldiers, practically speaking about what Giora Eilon is saying, which only a few examples were shown through the Hamas videos. It's something catastrophic, and the Israeli enemy does not have the courage to talk about it. Israel is trying to pretend like things will get better, but nothing will get better. Now we can say that Hamas is a 40,000 member organization and has thousands and thousands of anti-tank missiles. He was saying that the fighters hit their targets from inside the tunnels, by that the tunnels are exposed and they resort to the destroyed areas, and that is when Israeli warplanes come and hit these destroyed areas. Who said these fighters are waiting until your war jets come and target the destroyed areas? This is called an elusive and flexible enemy.
So just like Giora Eilon said, there are no signs of Hamas being beaten so far.
They do not understand what is awaiting them.
Surprises?
No, without surprises. If we are only talking about the current context, and let us say Hamas does not have any surprises or huge attacks that could explosively destroy tanks, or let us say they do not have huge explosive devices. Let us say they only have the Yassin missiles and a small number of Hamas fighters, which is 40,000. And as we calculated, only 250 of these fighters took part in the battles in destroying tanks in particular. The Israelis stand before a real catastrophe and will regret their ground invasion of Gaza, just like all American and Israeli experts suggested earlier. And they will consider that what happened on October 7th is too little in comparison to what is happening, because the Israeli army, with all its might and readiness, received such a huge defeat.
So what's happened in Gaza is that three of the Israeli occupation's components have been damaged, according to the former Israeli war minister, Yishtak Mordecai, who assured that one of which is Israeli deterrence. So everyone is waiting to see how this battle will end, especially the opposition of Netanyahu, who are protesting in the streets against him. They are holding him responsible for this huge defeat at the hands of the Palestinian resistance on the 7th of October. The main slogan the protesters shouted was for Netanyahu to resign. This is one of the protesters showering him with accusations of defeat. So, Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, you must resign today. Today. The calls for Netanyahu to resign are on the rise, both by the protesters and the families of the captives who were taken by the resistance in Gaza. What will be the fate of Netanyahu, in your opinion?
Now, Netanyahu, the Israeli entity, and the army focus on one point, which is military censorship. If facts are revealed in terms of the numbers of those killed, the tanks destroyed, and what is actually happening on the ground, Netanyahu, the army, the cabinet, and the entire Israeli entity will collapse. The main pillar now is this military censorship, and with time, it'll wane and become weaker. Yesterday, we saw the arrest of a reporter who filmed the bodies of the dead soldiers. And now, there has been a rule issued which says that every foreign reporter must also abide by military censorship. Because the reporter of Fox News said that in one ambush, 24 soldiers were killed, and this caused them issues. Therefore, Netanyahu is holding on to this straw and is trying to pretend like he has achieved victory through the bodies of the Palestinians and the army, too. I think that he supposes that if the war ends, he will be seen as the hero leader who actually saved Israel from Hamas, and by that, retrieve some of his image and wager on keeping himself in office or at least outside prison. This is what he is practically thinking about. But this is not what the Americans want. They are seeking change on the internal Israeli arena. According to opinion polls, Gantz is a candidate that is actually on the mind for this position these days. These voices we hear are part of the Gantz program and part of the opposition scheme. They want to keep him outside the government. Also, in an interview yesterday, he said that what happened on October 7th was because of the opposition and what had happened inside the army of opposition and objecting the judicial amendments. However, the case of the families of the captives is a milder case, unless this case was also merged into the opposition, and by the time the Qassam videos are disseminated, the snowball of opposition becomes only larger. The videos of the Qassam brigades are a very crucial point in this battle. We may say it is a pivotal point and decisive point. Every day, the people and the Israelis watch these videos and see that the promises that were made by Netanyahu are in fact not true and are vanishing.
We move on now from discussing Netanyahu to the minister in the Netanyahu government, Amihai Eliyahu, who called on bombing Gaza with a nuclear weapon to destroy it. He appeared on Israeli TV saying the souls of the Israeli captives are not important in this battle. Social media users commented on the call to hit Gaza with an atomic bomb, some were for and others against.
Omer Hofman.
This is another stupid person who destroys everything with some stupid words.
Shola.
When will you wake up from your blindness?
Kubinsik.
This is an option, but it is a severe violation of international law.
Ashkenazi.
He is right. This is the best way to end a story that is called Gaza.
Moshe Kuchef.
He is 100% right.
Nicole Blucher.
This is a perfect time to bring Gaza to an end.
You see.
Why only nuclear bomb Gaza? Also hit Lebanon and Iran.
So, Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, there are calls on hitting Gaza, Lebanon and Iran as well with a nuclear bomb. What do you think of this reflection on these calls on the Israeli arena and the other arenas too?
Well, he is not the first one to speak of a nuclear bomb at the beginning of the war on Gaza. I think that a journalist or an MP spoke about this matter. Second of all, talking about the killing of the Israeli captives, this is Netanyahu's policy. Netanyahu, the army, and everyone are killing the Israeli captives. So far, 60 were killed. No importance is attached to the captives because the problem is way bigger than the issue of the captives.
They were saying that war has a price.
Yes, war has a price. They see that these captives are part of the price paid for war. We cannot stop the operations against Hamas only for the sake of the captives. At the time, we already have 1,300 killed and 1,300 killed in the army. And we have a complicated crisis.
And these captives are not from the army.
Well, this is part of the price paid at war. Now, in terms of the statement on a nuclear bomb, I do not think this is his personal opinion. Talking about a nuclear bomb is also part of the American rhetoric. The submarine Ohio, which has arrived, also carries nuclear bombs. The Israeli fear of the results of the war, which are really ugly results, one of Israel's former officials said before the ground invasion of Gaza, and I think I mentioned it in this program. He said Israel will face an existential threat if it enters Gaza with huge ground forces. This is what will happen if things will continue as they are. The Israeli army will suffer severe losses on the level of ground troops. Israel will worry a lot when it will intend to resort its ground troops in the future. The first time it happened was in 1982, when Israel used its army in such a level and such an intensity. The Israelis will return to point zero in terms of readiness to combat and in terms of social acceptance to the immense losses, especially that all this will happen without any political or military fruits.
Anyway, the minister Eliyahu was not the only one amongst Israeli officials who called on wiping out of Gaza. Knesset member of the Likud party, Danny Danon, calling on emptying the land of Gaza of Palestinians. However, the seizing of the land could coincide with killing 50,000 of the people of Gaza. This is what one Israeli commentator said on the X platform. Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, what is the background of these calls and that this Zionist arrogance in seizing the land of Gaza and killing 50,000?
If you have seen the film Tantura, you can clearly see that these Israeli people have a criminal sense. Killing a child, killing the innocent, killing the elderly, all this reassures that these people do not have the right to have a state or own a financial, political, or media power. This case should be dismantled. We have a Palestinian cause and then have a Jewish cause next to it. There should be consensus among the peoples of the world that these Jewish people should not own arms or even a gun. We will reach this reality. We have been living with this since 1948 and until today. I saw another film, other than Tantura, on the crimes committed in 1948. The settler in the film says, I committed a massacre, and they were civilians. They did not have weapons. We said they were sabotagers, but they did not have any weapons. This nature is not related to October 7th.
Anyway, the Zionists did not see that taking the land of Gaza and killing 50,000 of its people as enough. The Knesset member, Ram Ben Barak, also called for kicking out the Gazans and distributing them across world countries to get rid of them. Israeli social media users reacted to these words, and here are a few comments of some Zionist activists.
Everyone is racing with Ben Gvir.
Edmond.
He is speaking like Kahana.
Nev.
We're ready for the plan of Ram Ben Barak for ethnic cleansing.
Shay.
Today, many understand that there is no better solution than leaving. Even if Hamas was totally destroyed, a similar Islamic organization will rise in the strip.
Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, transfer, ethnic cleansing, kicking people out. To what extent do you see these as part of the Israeli scheme in terms of Gaza and the entire occupied Palestine?
This has always been mentioned. There was talk earlier about transferring them to Egypt and to Jordan and other parts of the world. But the scheme they are trying to implement, and which Netanyahu clearly expressed as controlling Gaza on the military level and cleansing it from thought and culture, the same thing is applicable to the Jewish people themselves. They are refugees in Palestine. We always had a question, which was, where would the Jewish people go? He gave us an idea, Ram Ben Barak, that this entity, which was tested on October 7th in terms of its capability to survive and exist, the reality of this entity and its capability to survive will also be revealed in the ground invasion. They have the solution, so they can apply it to themselves.
Let us move on from the Gaza besieged strip to discuss the Lebanese front and the stance of the war minister, Yoav Gallant, who saw the Israeli entity is not entitled to enter war with Hezbollah. In the same context, former commander of the Zionist Navy, Eliezer Maron, has also had his comments on what is happening on the borders with Lebanon. Obviously, Gallant does not want to go to war with Hezbollah. The former head of the Navy forces said that the initiative to start a war is now in the hands of Hezbollah. What do you think?
Of course, it took Israel long talks and discussions among the cabinet members, the chief of staff, and even with American generals, until they decided to carry out a ground invasion in Gaza. Of course, entering Lebanon is a much tougher issue. Well, they had a pretext to invade Gaza due to the catastrophe that fell upon their heads on October 7th. If they were ready for Lebanon, why did they get their American allies to the region? Or why did the Americans clearly stated that they came to the region to deter Hezbollah? Because the Israelis told the Americans we're not able to confront Hezbollah. Hezbollah means targeting military airports and setting it out of service, hitting economic, military, security, and intelligence spots, and damaging them during the first 3 days of the battles. And Israel will need a military ally to support it. It'll not be an easy war, but the Israeli arena will be badly damaged and affected.
Of course, the situation at the borders with South Lebanon stirs concern that things may develop and a war might start there. This topic was discussed in the media of the Israeli enemy and was perceived as a long attrition war that is not in the interest of the occupation entity. Therefore, the situation on the borders with Lebanon are way more complicated than many think inside the Israeli entity. And it is what one of the Israeli analysts assured. What is your comment, Mr. Hadi Kobayesi?
They spoke about the area in the north. I think that according to what Yossi is saying, is that the settlements at the north and the military posts in the north will not exist. In case the Israeli entity wanted to create a security belt in South Lebanon, there will be a security belt and cleansing to the settlements easily, and they know this very well.
Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, head of Al-Ithiyat Center for Studies and Research, thank you so much for being with us in this episode of Israeli Watch, and thank you. See you on our next episode. Goodbye.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. I'm Mustafa, as your host, and with me is Brother Alavi in the studio. He has a PhD in philosophy and is an Islamic researcher. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
How are you doing?
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me to your show.
Thank you so much. So, brother, we were discussing our duties during the time of the occultation of the 12th Imam and what we can do during this time. And we've been discussing many different topics during these episodes. One of the, I think, big questions that came to my mind, you know, through these discussions that I really wanted to ask is, we have this image in our mind, you know, that once the Imam comes, we'll be living in this sort of paradise or utopia, everything will be just. But considering human nature, it just seems too good to be true almost, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, my question is, will there be any resistance? Will there be oppression? You know, there must be something going on. What do we know about that?
Look, when we are talking about that utopia that inshallah Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will introduce to the world, about the characteristics of his government and the leadership of an infallible imam, and rulership of this just imam, we are talking about the characteristics of this government, not the people. I mean, look, people, if they are interested, they can increase their knowledge, they can increase their ma'rifa, their science, and they can benefit, I mean, very easily, because everything is already there, I mean, available for them to use. But to see that if in a sense there would be any sort of sin to be committed, any sort of oppression to happen, any sort of, let's say, distortion to happen, these are the things that usually happen due to the personal desires of the people.
Right.
And the desires of the people are always there, and they have been in the course of history. Allah is not going to, for example, change my own personal desire and yours as well. For example, to take, okay, from now on, everything should be clear, and now, from now on, you should have to only think positively.
Right.
The people are the people. I mean, but they are going to benefit from a source of blessing. Among the nations that Imam is going to lead in this universe, there would be different kinds of people.
Right.
There might be some, for example, oppressors among the people, but not in the level of the government.
I see.
The government is going to establish justice there.
I see. So what you're saying is that the people will still have the same desires. They may sin as they still do, of course.
Like, or in life they have. For example, they might commit sin, but in case they want to get perfected and find their way towards this voyage of perfection, it's quite available.
The opportunities will be there. There will be justice at a societal level.
Yeah, but if a distortion is going to happen again in Islamic basis and principles, because Nadin and Allah al-Islam, the religion in Allah's presence is Islam.
Right.
So if any distortion is going to happen, no, there is a firm, just government that is actually stopping people from going astray, right?
Right, right.
But this oppressions might happen, these distortions might happen. Even, let me give you an example. At the time of global and universal government of Prophet Sulaiman,
yeah,
many people were after finding some ways to make some magics among the people, just to break the relationship between a husband.
Right. This is from the Quran, right?
Yeah, this is what Allah
mentioned
in the Quran.
Specifically.
Yeah, to break the relationships of the couples.
Right.
So it happened at the time of Solomon the Prophet, but he could stop them from doing that, and going astray. But because the government is just. I mean, if they refer to government to complain from a person, from an entity, so that everything is available for them to find the justice. Again.
Sorry, I'm going to have to stop you right there because we have to go for a break.
Sure.
And sorry about, we'll continue right when we're back.
I can feel your eyes, like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
So we were discussing once the imam arrives, you know, we were saying that there will be oppression, maybe there may be distortion, but because there will be a just government, they will be there to prevent it from maybe increasing, yeah, and they'll be able to control it and contain it. Is that correct?
Very true.
You were going to make another point, I believe.
Yeah, I want to even give you another surprising point that we are waiting for Imam to come and make the religion of God into only one, that is Al-Islam. Based on some narrations, we find even like the city-state model that the Holy Prophet introduced to the world, and this was a just model, that he himself was the head of that government.
Right.
We see that there were some Jews living there, there were some Christians living at his state, right? Even there is a possibility of, based on some narrations, the possibility of some Jews and Christians living at the time of Imam, but they're benefiting and favoring and enjoying from a just government.
That makes
because
sense.
Islam is not going to impose Islam into their minds and to change their own beliefs. They have, as I told you, they have this opportunity. Everything is ready for them to come and accept and agree.
You know, I always thought that we have so many different religions that to me, it didn't make logical sense that everyone would, like, for example, become Muslim.
Overnight.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that would be the case, that the imam would possibly have treaties, have, you know, peace treaties with other. Why would he fight with people, for example, right?
Yeah.
But I would only assume that he would. I don't want to go into another topic, but, you know, he would just fight people in defensive form, just like the Prophet did.
Very true.
Right? Otherwise, he would
be imagine the same way that the people referred to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam or other imams from different religions. They came to him. But Imam respected all those people because all belong to the realm of rulership of these imams.
Yeah, right?
But if these words are good to be used, because they are, I mean, imams are not taking these terms or these concepts in a materialistic way. When I'm talking about realms or, let's say, rulership, it does not mean materialistically speaking. But I mean, because they are all belonging to the creatures of God and they are the representative of God and the scene of the caliphs of God.
I want to challenge you now. Sure. Okay? You brought up Prophet Sulaiman, right?
Yeah.
In Prophet Sulaiman's story, there is a very famous where he sends a letter to the queen of, I believe, what was the name of the town? Is it Sheba?
Bilqis.
Bilqis, right? And in that, he almost forces her to, he says, you know, if you don't come towards me, I'm going to come and crush you guys, right? Or is my understanding incorrect of that? I mean, I guess I'm trying to ask you is that you're saying that the imam would allow other religions or other people to exist. Mm-hmm. Whereas we've seen Prophet Sulaiman's story, he didn't force them, but he definitely, how would you explain that, I guess?
Look, he did not force them to change their beliefs, to change their methods of acting with people, right? But it doesn't have anything to do with their beliefs to change it. But then when he found that Sulaiman was that kind and merciful, they themselves, voluntarily changed their own beliefs.
So the stories now are consistent.
Yeah.
Yes,
but I think it has to be a little bit with care because it is Quran. We need to be careful.
Yeah. We don't want to go off completely off the topic. Yeah. What would you say is something that we can relate to right now? In terms of what we're talking about, I think there's things that we can relate to in our lives right now, right? In terms of distortions that are happening in religion right now, an oppression that is happening right now. Do you see those examples around you in current times that we can relate to?
Look, there are many examples of oppression and distortions happening in our time here and even in the past. And even they might happen at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, even at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But the difference is, as I was explaining, if even today in this Islamic government that we are living in, if you refer to a court, what you see at the end of the day, the vote that has been issued and decreed is against what you think and what you imagine. And even you might find it even anti-religious basis from your own perspective, right?
Right.
But from the Islamic judge who is sitting there, I mean, and judging that, he believes that no, he issued and decreed an Islamic rule for you or Islamic decree for you. But this deficiency would not exist at the time of Imam Ali.
I see.
Everywhere
I see.
You find justice. Yes, you find a distortion, you refer to, and you make a complaint against them, and you refer them to, for example, a court case. But the result would be beautiful. The result would be sweet for the people, to find that they're sensing this beauty.
The system works.
The system works.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll have to go for a break, and we'll come back for the discussion right afterwards.
True.
Okay, so right before the break, we were saying, you know, the system, the justice system will work, and that will be the beautiful side of the imam system. And that will prevent a lot of the oppression and distortion from expanding, from corrupting the society, for example. You know, I was just thinking that we become so accustomed to corruption that it sounds almost unbelievable, you know, that something like that can even happen. But even when it happens today, though, we find that people are attracted to it, right? When we hear a case where justice took place, we do feel happy towards it, and we're excited about that. And one thing, for example, that we used to hear when I was younger, you know, where I grew up, is that we used to hear, you know, that the Western societies are, for example, very just, you know, that they give justice. And that was a means of attracting people to those societies, right? True. You're saying that in the future, the imam will be that attraction. He will be, it won't be that fake justice that the West is offering, it'll be real justice that that he'll be offering us. Are there any other points, any other things that you would like to tell us that you think we should know about, you know, during those times before we finish this discussion?
Actually, one of the names of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is Adl, that is justice.
Right.
That is, we even in the supplications, we recite As-salamu ala al-adl al-muntadhar. That is awaiting justice to come. So actually, he's going to complete the mission that has started from Adam alayhi salam, from the beginning of the creation. So whatever was missing in the missions of the prophets, or there were some obstacles on the implementation of it for the people, because human being is in thirst of justice rather than anything else.
Right.
Even more than he's in thirst of water and food and in actually in need of these things, he's in thirst of justice. So Imam comes for that very important cause to happen. So when people see the change, they will get happy. They will get satisfied with what has been introduced and presented to them.
Definitely. I think I agree with you that today we are suffering because in all of the systems that we see, there are problems, there are faults, there are mistakes, there's corruption. And we all pray for the reappearance of the imam to remove this suffering.
And this is the reason that we have actually, prioritized other systems over the systems of imamate in the course of history. We chose another way to go. And we ourselves deprived ourselves from his presence. If we get ready, he will come.
Yes.
And he is more interested for us to come rather than us to him.
Yes. So the way is for us to also implement justice in our lives. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Inshallah, until our next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining?
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
But one of the questions that I want to try and answer in this topic about the youth especially and this guidance which I call a give-and-take relationship is that why do we find youth primarily, but even older people, distancing themselves from religion, if not completely leaving Islam altogether? I'm sure all of us in this room know somebody, maybe a family member, maybe a friend, a co-worker, a classmate born into a Muslim family, born into a Shia family, a family that would come to the Majlis of Muharram. And for some reason, the young man or woman in that family no longer identifies with Islam. Right? They don't find value in the majlis. It's the same story repeated over and over again. Right? And I probably said the same thing growing up in Edmonton when I was dragged to the majlis every year, that this is the same story repeated over and over again. What's the benefit in it for me? What do I get out of religion? I pray, I don't see that I get my du'as answered. I want this, I don't get it. I pray, I don't get this. And I see all my non-Muslim friends having fun, enjoying life, partying, doing this, doing that. So why should I bother to stay within this religion that has really blocked me in and boxed me in? I can't enjoy the world that everybody else is enjoying. So why do people feel like this? And again, not just from a theory, I've seen this in my own circle of friends, people that I grew up with in Edmonton who now no longer identify as Muslims. Their name is a Muslim name. They have that connection. They might still eat cultural food, but they have lost all semblance of Islam. You know, to the point where sometimes they have told me that, you know, I fasted this Ramadan for the first time in 20 years. I've had friends tell me this, that they haven't fasted for 10, 20 years. They've just left it all. They left praying, they left fasting. Everything is out the window. Obviously, there are different reasons why people feel this way. One of them is the society that we are born and brought up in. Right? We live in a very secular society. It's over-secularized, I would say, in the last 15 to 20 years. Back in the day, people had religiosity, whether it be Christianity or whatever, but there was religion. And people had petitions in the early 80s that we want the malls to stay open, to open rather on a Sunday. I remember those days. People had some sense of religion back then. They recognized that Sunday should be spent in resting with the family, doing church or whatever you do, but there was a sense of family, of community, of religion back then. And we know that now things have changed, not only Monday to Friday and Saturday, Sunday, it's 24 hours a day. Some of these mega, you know, mega box stores, they stay open 24/7. So yes, society plays a huge role in why many of our youth or even elders are leaving religion. Sometimes it's our own family members. One family member drifts away and they take a sibling with them. Or the mother or father drift away and they take the children with them to the path of leaving Islam. Many times it's our friends. And that's why the Prophet had said that Al-Mar'u ala dini khalilihi. A person is on the religion of their friend, on the path and ideology of their friends. So the Prophet says, be careful who you befriend. Right? Very rarely will you come across friends, again, whether they're Muslim or not, who will keep you on the path. You know, if we have those kind of friends in our lives, thank Allah that you have them. But many times your friends will want you to be involved in what they're doing. Drugs, alcohol, sexual promiscuity, whatever the case may be. Our friends will be into it, and unfortunately even so-called Muslims. And they will drag us with them into that pit of not only hell in the world to come, but hell in this world, because you will have to pay the price for your decisions in this world. Another reason why people leave Islam is because they're not given the true, correct understanding of this religion. Whether that be from people who have not studied Islam in the traditional seminaries, and not only traditional seminary studies, but have worked on purification of the soul, because believe you me, I have seen, and I'm sure many of our scholars have seen, people who have gone to Qom, gone to Najaf for 5, 10, 15 years. They have turbans on which are 12 meters, 15 meters of material, massive turbans bigger than your tires on your SUV, and they're the most deviant of people. They're misguiding people, not because they didn't study. They studied great, but they didn't maybe have that purification of the soul. They weren't there for the right reasons. It was about money. It was about power. It was about establishing themselves as the head of an institution, as an organization. And so many times we lose our religion because we're not given a clear picture of it. I remember many, many years ago, this is like more than 20 years back, a young man told me that he was on the brink of leaving religion. And we were talking about many different things, and one of the things he said is that his parents have been feeding him all of this information over the years, which didn't make sense to him. It was illogical how Islam could have certain things, some certain beliefs. And I asked him for a couple. And one of the things he says, well, I'm into sports. I'm into a lot of different activities and sports. And I'm told that I'm not allowed to do sports. I said, well, why would that be? Are you dressed inappropriately? Are you playing games with the opposite gender? What is it? He goes, no, I'm told that if I jump on the ground, if I play basketball and I'm shooting hoops and I'm, you know, jumping, because I'm landing on the ground with my feet, the ground will complain to Allah on the Day of Judgment that this guy was jumping on top of me. And he said, what kind of a religion would pass that kind of a ruling, a fatwa, that I can't even jump or play sports because now the ground will complain that I jumped on the earth? It was a simple thing in my eyes, but for him, because sports was his everything, he thought, this doesn't make sense. How can a religion which encourages, you know, us to be active in archery and horseback riding and swimming and sports and, you know, all of these things, how can it then put me in a position of being accountable to God on the Day of Judgment? And people tell me other stories that they hear from their parents. Not because their parents meant bad, but because for the most part, these parents came with very little sound knowledge of Islam. They came from communities and countries where they didn't have scholars educating them. So the point being is that many times we end up mixing religion and culture to the extent, or completely providing illogical rulings, that our youth especially begin to leave Islam. When they see that culture is saying one thing, no, you can't marry this person because they're not from our tribe back home. Because you're a Sayyida, you can't marry a non-Sayyid. Well, what about Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Reza Gulpaygani, the late? He married his daughter to a sheikh, to a non-Sayyid, Ayatollah Sheikh Lutfullah Safi Gulpaygani, marhum, who passed away recently. A marja taqlid, who's a Sayyid, he marries his daughter to a non-Sayyid. And you look at the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, right? They married women from Nubia, from Africa, from Morocco, from the Northwest Africa, from Sudan. If you believe the story of the 12th Imam marrying Narjis Khatun, there are alternative theories. She was from Rome. She wasn't a Sayyida in the lineage of Banu Hashim, but yet the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, the 12th Imam's mother, apparently she's from Rome. So she would have been of Christian descent, Caucasian. She wasn't a Sayyida in that definition. But yet we have this cultural baggage. No, if the boy isn't a Sayyid from this village in Pakistan or whatever country, then you can't marry him. And so then our youth will do whatever they want because